Hey, I'm Nick DiMatteo, and welcome to Music Is Not a Genre's Podfast. No pause for thank you, Podfast, for being very gentle here, because I don't know, we did some fun stuff last week, and I almost got crushed, or not last week, but last Podfast. This is Podfast number 19, by the way. And in Podfast 18, I read to you my treatise, The $50,000 Manifesto, right? And this Podfast, the name of this Podfast is Why You Deserve $50,000. So you might be asking, first of all, man, I sound like an infomercial and I am really excited about that, or maybe a TED Talk. I don't know, but it's not. And so you probably are asking, why in the world would I do back-to-back Podfasts? Thankfully, not back-to-back episodes. I like to mix it up on this idea of $50,000 when this is a music podcast. Well, there are a couple of reasons. First, I honestly expected much more of a response from an episode titled Give Me $50,000, especially from people who think I'm crazy, which is always fun. And I may get more of a response. I've gotten more on, you know, social and things like that at the same time. And I've had people buy this shirt, Give Me $50,000, and a few of them, actually. So I guess that can still happen. But, you know, like I said, I expected a little more out of the gate. Second, this is a topic that absolutely deserves and needs more discussion, because it affects all of us, whether or not we are musicians or artists, more maybe now than ever. Right. So what compelled me to even do a second episode? There are plenty of ways to talk about this. I could have done it in one of my catch-up episodes, et cetera, et cetera. But I decided to do a second full Podfast. Why? Okay, so my wife, Catherine, was away in California, and she was reminded, I think because of talk about tinnitus, which a lot of us have, of a movie that she had seen a while back, a documentary called I Am, by Tom Shadyac, who was famous for, you know, Evan Almighty and Bruce Almighty, like just so many comedies with a brain, you could say, but still goofy, I guess. And so she said, watch it. While she was gone, and I did, and I expected to be, you know, intrigued and interested, but it actually inspired me in several ways. There were a few things that led to a couple of lyrics and some, you know, other things that I am crafting, etc. But one way was to talk about something that they mentioned in conjunction with the $50,000 manifesto. It's something they called, that the Native American tribes, certain tribes called Wetiko, which to them was a sickness that happened in their tribe, for sure, in their tribes, but also shown to them to be rampant among people from Europe. And what it is this. So Wetiko is the sickness, which they call it, and I would agree, that you need more than you need. In fact, that having as much as you need to live and live well is not enough. And you are on a quest to get more and more and more at the expense of others. And this happens to individuals, certainly. But worse than that, more than that, it happens to societies. And I think one of the things the movie was saying, and this is a movie that's over a decade old, and, you know, we're kind of still in the same era of, you know, stuff. So it's not that much of a surprise, but that's a stretch. And that things haven't changed, or if they have, they've gotten worse. And that is that we've been gripped with Wetiko for a long time, but it's a little bit more detailed than that. That's a bit of a broad statement. But it has shaped every facet of our society. Again, now maybe more than ever. So how does this relate to a music podcast? How did the first one relate? I made some relations to it as far as, you know, musicians. But yes, economics affect commerce, which affects art in both content and consumption. It affects the ability for artists to do their art. I have a campaign now on GoFundMe called I Can't Afford to Be an Artist, Give Me $50,000. Why did I put that up there? Partly because I thought it was funny, but partly because I would like that money, but also because it is a point, which is, if we have found a profession that we love and we've been doing it well and, you know, making decent money at it, and some would say even a living, and then you can't all of a sudden because of economic changes and the way society is, it sucks and it's ridiculous. I'm going to go into that a little bit more later on. But this also relates to other arts, of course, but also anything any of us do and are still struggling to make ends meet. I mean, I know that my life is being impeded by, you know, Wetico or, you know, whatever you want to call it in this society. And again, we'll go into more detail, but not nearly as much as people, as homeless people, as you know, people who are on food stamps and are struggling just to even eat. So I'm suffering in my own minor ways, and it's been years and years of struggle, but it's nowhere near what a lot of people go through. In particular in this country, but also certainly beyond this country. And we're going to examine that a little bit and, you know, again, tie it a little bit to music as well. So summary of the $50,000 manifesto, and then my purpose for doing a second episode on it a little further than what I've already said. So if you didn't listen to Podfast 18 or watch me get crushed, which was fun. It was a few weeks ago, I think 3 weeks ago. I'm not sure when this is coming out. I recited my treatise called The $50,000 Manifesto and talked about it in depth, both in the context of a music arts career and as it applies to everyone doing anything, as I have mentioned. I called it a manifesto because it's wordy and a little ranty, and that's a fun word to use. But it's also well-reasoned, detailed, and insightful, and I'll put a link to it. You can read it or just watch the previous podcast, which is what makes it a treatise. It's not just a rant, and it's based in fact, and it's based in reasoning and logic. And I also like how the title makes me sound crazy and plays right into the joke, which is not a joke, of demanding $50,000. It's on my shirt here. As the weather gets warmer here in New York City, I'm going to be wearing this out without an overshirt, and I'll be curious to see how people respond, because again, sure, it's a joke, but it also is very, very serious. Because do I want the money? Yes. Who of us wouldn't want $50,000, especially if it's no strings attached, but really in any legit way that wouldn't hurt others. Do I think I'll get it? Yeah, I think I'll get it one way or another, especially if one of you listening for whom $50,000 is a drop in the bucket wants to go ahead and give me that. Go ahead to the campaign. I'll put the link down there, or however you want to do it. Sure. You want to do something different with your life? If it's not me, find another artist and give them $50,000. Find somebody struggling and give them $50,000. Do I want it from you if you don't have it to spare? No. No. In fact, I hate asking for money from anybody who doesn't have it to spare, because I know what that feels like. And that's why I'm so grateful for my Patreon people, patreon.com/musicisnotagenre. I'm so grateful for my recarea.bandcamp.com people who are members there. And I'm so grateful for anybody who buys a t-shirt or a mug or streams my music or anything like that, because we're all struggling, you know. Hell, I'll take 200 at this point, you know. So the manifesto focused mostly on income inequality and how the universal basic income, UBI, is more than worthy solution and a reasonable one, as a matter of fact. It's not nearly as crazy as people make it sound. Just as reparations aren't. I went into detail about all of that in the Podfast 18 and some related topics. Some hard numbers that my wife and I talked about when we were talking about the movie I Am and also the manifesto. And that is that if each of the top 10 earners in the world gave just 30% of their wealth, a percentage they would make back very quickly, and that wouldn't hurt them even if they didn't make it back. If those top 10 richest people gave 30%, 720,000 people could get $50,000 each. If all of the top 1%, which makes a collective $35.8 trillion as of a year or two ago, gave just 30% of their income, again, money they could make back, money they could all make back quickly, and it wouldn't matter anyway, almost 215 million people could each get $50,000. If all of the top 10% gave 30% collectively, and I'll tell you that in a second, every American citizen could get $50,000. So that means that the idea of a universal basic income is not ridiculous. It's not. It's not. We used to have this baked into our society, and it's been slowly eroded, and I'll talk about that later. If and when I think of the top 10%, there are people who make quote unquote only 170,000 or whatever the threshold is. And yes, that's still a lot of money for most of us, but it's not a lot in comparison to the top 5 or top 1%. So I get that, or the top 10 period. So let's say they gave 10% or 5%, and the people who made closer to the millions and billions gave 30 or 40 or 50% in just a given year. That's it. And again, they'd make it back. Everybody could get $50,000. Everybody would have a UBI. We'd all be able to live regardless of whether we were homeless or hard workers or whoever, because work is not the end and beginning of life. What I didn't do in the last podcast was contextualize the current state of things in relation to the manifesto and the ideas therein, and illustrate how we got here and how and when we easily could have changed course. And that's what this episode will do. So let's get to it. How did we get here? Something I read in the New York Times a couple of years ago called something about the I-We-I cycle. And I may be making the name up, but the idea is that in the 1920s, let's say, we were at the height of the I cycle, meaning it was every person for themselves. You get what you can get and screw everybody else. And what did that lead to? It led to the Great Depression and so many other things. But it also led to the institution of social programs under FDR in the 1930s and then 40s and then more with Truman and then, civil rights laws and things like that in the 1950s and 60s, which brings us 50 years forward from 1920 to 1970, which was the height of the we, where society as a whole, again, not everyone, but as a whole, the idea was we were all doing our best to help each other. But of course, there were people, as there always are, who were dead set on reversing that. So they launched a concerted effort, both overtly and covertly, to strip away support systems, regulations, etc., making it much more possible for the people with money and power to retain that and have more and more and more, and the people without to, who cares? Honestly, they don't really care, you know? And so 1970 to 2020 is another 50 years. We are now currently, and according to this article, and I would agree, at the height again of the I cycle. So will it take another 50 years for us to get back to the we cycle? I don't think so. I think things move faster now. And we've already started to make progress in some ways. Sure, certain things have been eroded, Roe v. Wade and regulations, and I'll talk about that later. But we've also made progress in gay marriage and other social programs that have assisted people and so many other things. It's a struggle right now because everyone's taken sides, and that's partly the problem. And so, of course, not everything is dire, but I do believe we're at the height of the, every person for themselves. It used to be that the ultra rich, it was their obligation, social obligation to give back. And it was an unwritten rule for thousands of years. And that just sort of disappeared slowly over the last 100 years, at least, if not more. I can vouch for the change in the last 50 years because compared to my parents' ability to live on a similar level of work, I mean, I'm doing as much work as my dad or my mom or whatever. And they were able to afford 2 cars and vacations and to take time off without vacation pay and et cetera, and even have a savings and blah, blah, blah. That was middle class. We can't afford any of that right now. Many of us cannot afford a car or vacations all the time or vacations at all or anything like that. 1 car, let alone 2. And we're still considered middle class. Like, we know that things have changed, right? And that's one proof that despite reports, the economy is not improving. And if that's your takeaway from this, then go run with it. The economy is not improving. Not for the vast majority of us. So the movie I Am talked about how the healthiest, most successful, and longest lasting societies grew to where they understood that supporting everyone benefits everyone. And there's a legit point after which one person or entity, say a company, corporation, accumulating more does nothing for that person or entity while harming so many others, in many cases, millions of others. And we are talking, these societies thrived many hundreds of years beyond what we've already achieved. So there's something to be said for that type of thinking, that just take what you need, maybe a bit more if you want a little comfort, but then, that's it. Make sure everybody else has enough too. They also talked in the movie about how it usually takes a big upheaval or two, a disaster or whatever, to get a society to course correct from the infinite growth, which, by the way, my recent single, Rex's recent single, Porch Step, name checks infinite growth, because part of that song is about, is work the answer to everything, is feeling bad because you're just sitting around on a porch step, really a reason to feel bad, or is being able to just breathe and exist a good enough reason to live? Infinite growth sucks. So what happened in the decades before the last 50 years to get us to course correct? Like I said, FDR and social programs, civil rights laws. Robber barons, which we know of, if you know history, from the 1890s through 1920s, 30s, whatever, before regulations set in. The flu pandemic, 1918, I believe, whatever that was, 1920. Wars, World War I, World War II, and all that. Nazism and the Red Scare and the atom bomb threat all were disasters or upheavals or things that kind of compelled us as a society to make some changes. And they weren't easy changes, but they happened. And they made a huge difference. Not for everyone. There were always people then who were suffering more than they're suffering now, in a sense. And it is true that on the whole in the world, there is less suffering and less war than there was 100 years ago. So there are certain things that have improved. But we can't deny, we can't deny the fact that as prevalent as racism and sexism and all and genderism and all that stuff is now, it was way worse way back. It just was. So we do all that. We get to a place where we feel like we have a new society and things are starting to hum in terms of changes and progress and all of that in the late 60s, early 70s. And then things sort of got a little quieter than they have been in previous decades. There were wars, but they weren't as big. There were, you know, other changes in society and good and bad, Roe v. Wade and all of that stuff and so many other things that happened. But it wasn't quite as tumultuous as the previous decade. So we were sort of lulled into a sense, a false sense of security that things would just continue to improve for everyone. Which, you mean, like I said in the last PopFest, the American dream is a lie. Through the 1970s, through the 1990s, they weren't quiet. We know stuff happened then, lots of it, but they weren't quite as tumultuous as the previous decades. And so those people who were making that effort to roll back regulations and stuff like that did it in spades. And I'll get to there when we get to that point in history, which is very soon. And as I said, there were significant changes. Like I said, more civil rights. Gay marriage was passed. Reproductive rights until recently. More child protection until, again, recently. Rolling back arcane state laws for things like interracial marriage and stuff like that. Although, again, states' rights, stupid, annoying on almost every level. And we've seen states do things with voting laws and laws about the sex and, you know, all this other stuff that have made life, in those states, for people in those states, pretty hellish. Laws were being passed or repealed at the same time that changed the structure of how things like corporations, taxes, educations, prisons, policing, guns, healthcare, etc. would function. And the driving factor in all those is money. I came to the conclusion a few years ago, which is one of the things that a couple of years later prompted me to write this treatise, was that almost every problem at heart in society comes down to money, comes down to someone wanting more money somewhere else, taking money away from people who need it or support systems and programs and things that need it, whatever, or making things for profit that shouldn't be for profit, like healthcare and education. So here's something. In 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. It was created in 1933 after the freaking Depression to prevent commercial banks from speculative risk-taking, because that was one of the things that caused the Depression, along with all the monopolies and robber barons and everything, which also got busted up. That was repealed in 99. So by the time the 2000s rolled around, those changes were starting to impact the economy. We had the internet bubble in 99. We had Enron in the early 2000s. We had the 2007 and 8 economic collapse and housing bubble. And pretty much everything in the last 15 years points towards how these regulation rollbacks have screwed us all. and haven't necessarily made those companies any more profitable, except for the top few who get bonuses that are way disproportionate, you know, again, income inequality. In the meantime, certain liberals and progressives in that period in the 90s and before, certainly, you had Reagan, Democrats and whatever, were moving towards the center and beginning to normalize ideas that even centrist Democrats would have considered outrageous just a couple of decades earlier. I'm not a fan of Nixon, but there were things that he considered kind of standard that to a Democrat in the 90s would have been considered ultra liberal. That's how much things shifted from the I mentality or from the we mentality to the I mentality. And then, of course, you know, at the beginning, we had 9/11, and then mentioning the economic and housing collapse. And the thing that reason I'm mentioning that again is because the few years after that, when Obama was president, and whether it was his complete responsibility or fault is up to someone else to decide, that the problems were handled again in a very trickle-down way. And if there's one thing we know about history, is that trickle-down theory is bullshit. It doesn't work. It never has, and it never will. So to say that the only solution to the economic crisis was to bail out the banks was ridiculous. There were other solutions. It was the easiest solution because it was the one that most people would support in power, but it wasn't the best by far. And we are seeing the results of that 15 years later or 10 years later or whatever it is. Then the pandemic hit, and there was a little brief period there where we thought we were going to get some changes. And then a lot of that was repealed and rolled back and ended. And now we have a rise in economic disparity and rent and cost of things, and not a rise in income, and overall malaise, not just in this city, but the malaise, that sense of depression and frustration and anger has just increased. And here we are. So what could we have done? What did we actually do? We could have been more aware of the efforts to erode our protections like Glass-Steagall and legislated against them, but we felt things were going well, so what's the big deal? I talked about trickle-down. We could have communicated better to our opponents. We still can. Helping them understand it's also in their best interest to not follow the lead of fear-mongers whose actual agenda has nothing to do with any of our well-being, no matter what they say, no matter what side you're on. It's not about them helping you. It's about them fooling you into thinking they'll help you and then taking your money. And I don't mean taking your money and giving it to someone who needs it more. I mean taking your money for them who don't need it at all. We could have put more safeguards in place to not have most of the money be funneled to the fewest people and corporations. We could have regulated Wall Street and corporations and individual wealth better. We could have legislated more protection for the least fortunate. Some of this we've done, but a lot of it we've just been shunted aside in favor of thinking that people are leeches or, you know, welfare queens, all that bullshit. It's bullshit. We could have kept this just like voter fraud is bullshit. We could have kept the cooperative spirit of post 9/11 going and built more safety nets and baked in more ability for us to earn more and keep what we earn instead of just thinking that more police and more guns and all that stuff and more war was the answer. And none of that worked. Occupy or Occupy Wall Street, whatever, which was a bit of a joke in a lot of ways, but the basic premise and at least the heart and thought behind it was good. But it could have had a clearer message and a better structure and a more pointed agenda, I think. It was a little bit of a half-hearted effort. We could have communicated less like we have to take sides and more like we're in this together. I talk about this all the time. Division is the thing that kills us all, just like fear. And we're not on different sides. We have more agreement than disagreement in many, many cases, and probably almost all cases. But it's to the people in power and people with money's best interest for us to fight amongst ourselves and blame each other instead of blaming them. Again, the 08 collapse should have first addressed the least fortunate, start from the bottom up, and not assumed that saving the banks was the best and only way to save all of us. Trickle the fuck down didn't fucking work. Okay, it made things worse. We are seeing that now. We could have communicated better about things like Black Lives Matter and defund the police and even Gaza, again, in ways that show that they benefit all of us. Meaning this, if you're going to use a buzzword, even if you agree with it, like The genocide is the big thing right now. If all that's going to do is shut down people's brains, then find a different way to express it. If you are a person who thinks that the only answer to communicating this stuff is to use those buzzwords, because it's more important to be forceful with your argument than to try to get your point across, then you are a problem too. You just are. So not making it an either or, an us or them. That's really what it is. Finding not a middle way, because I think there's a point at which compromise does water down things too much. But there is a third way, which has happened in history. People have done it. Governments have done it. Corporations or at least organizations have done it. We could have understood and conveyed that the scarcity mindset hurts us all, meaning that if someone else has more, we have less. No, if that's the case, it's not because of that person who is as struggling as much as you are. It's because of the people who already have enough and want more of that. There is more than enough to go around of everything, of food, of money, of shelter, all of it. More than enough. Space, healthcare, more than enough to go around. It's just that too much of it is either controlled by or in the hands of too few, who push us to demonize others who want simply because they need, by making us think that means that they take it away from us, when those people don't want to take it away from us. And by those people, I mean anybody you think of as an other. So like quote unquote, those people, right? Someone who is a peer of yours, but you don't see as a peer, you see as an other. They're not looking to take it away from you. It's the few at the top who do the taking and the hoarding. We could have put rules in place to prevent record companies from again, siphoning our money as artists by the fistful. Some people got at the beginning of the internet that the internet would change things. We were too slow to respond, to put in safeguards. And now we have things like Spotify giving more money to the artists who are already making more money and taking what little money we make completely away in many cases. And that's a very common thing across the board in this industry. It is, again, lack of legislation and regulation and allowing these corporations to do whatever they wanted, to give money to the people who already have it instead of apportioning it fairly, equitably, whether or not that means you believe in a universal basic income. And honestly, I don't want to blame those big artists, because they're probably wonderful people, many of them, and I'm sure they do things behind the scenes that are very charitable, but they need to speak up. Like the way Neil Young did and the way Joni Mitchell did. And I know that they relented and they're on Spotify, and I'm sure there are reasons for that. And I read that letter and I get it. And that's fine. But they spoke up. They tried to make a difference. The way Pearl Jam spoke up with Ticketmaster. You need to be vocal about what you're doing and what you believe, the Taylor Swifts of the world and people like that, because we need that consensus of opinion. We could have let any one of the thousands of mass shootings propel us toward logical and reasonable gun laws, among other determining factors. I'm not even going into that here. We could have had enough healthcare support to cover all illnesses for everyone instead of making it spend more money on the cure and on the treatment of an illness as opposed to the prevention. Could have learned the lessons of the pandemic, which is when you care more about yourself than everyone in total, we all suffer. More people die, more people get sick. Physically and economically, we all suffer more. There were so many things got better when people had money during that brief period. And so many things now are worse than they were beforehand. We thought we'd come out with motivation for a better world, and it just didn't last. Maybe we just aren't strong enough to do it. It's been taken away and things are worse off. And I'm sorry, that's just the case. So bottom line is, by now, we should have learned enough lessons from so many disasters and so many upheavals that we would have changed course by now. Are we changing course? Maybe we are. Hopefully, again, it's not going to be as slow as 50 years, but we shouldn't have gotten here in the first place. It shouldn't have gone this far. So it sounds bleak. And I mean, in a lot of ways it is, let's be honest, that's just how things are right now. But again, like I said, there have been some good things that have happened. So let's get to some conclusions, which are what we're doing and what we can do. So again, are we changing course? To some degree, but it's slow. Hopefully that will accelerate. It's hard when so many judges have been appointed who are rolling back things that have helped people. But we'll see how that goes. again, like I said in the beginning, my hope is that the faster pace of life and commerce and communication and all that will speed up this 50-year cycle, because we have a long way to go. We really do. I don't know how else to say it. I think something else we can do, we can continue to communicate and connect with compassion. This is not really a conversation that I'm having. I'm kind of going off here and spouting what I believe. If you were with me, I would probably listen to you first, to be honest, and then try to understand more before expounding on what I believe. And I would then not just have something in the chamber and say, okay, you said yours, now I'm going to say mine. I would temper what I say based on what you just said, because that's how real conversation happens. And that's how connection happens. That's how change happens. That's a better way to talk to people we disagree with, you know? Like, why? In fact, this is something that gets me. Progressives know what I've been talking about. And a few of them talk about it. Bernie Sanders, AOC, you know, a bunch of others. Ilhan Omar, I guess. I don't know quite well. But there aren't enough progressives pointing directly at the people with money and power who are, controlling, I think, is a bit of a conspiracy word, but who are creating, who have over the course of decades created the situation that we're in now. And to call out people who are out and out lying and saying, they say they're going to help you, but they're not. They're saying that, you know, immigrants are going to harm this country is a way to divide all of us and make things worse for all of us, not just for immigrants. It's going to get worse for you too. Because eventually, if they come for one group, they come for all groups that aren't them. They just do. Our true enemy is not the person next to us who looks or acts or believes different. It's the people who already have the power and money. We can stop assuming that our only value to society is our work. And our only justification for having enough money to live on every level is that work. We really need to stop that. That's some Puritan work ethic bullshit. Just living is enough. There are plenty of societies where it has nothing to do with work. You are respected because you're a human. And that's what the universal basic income is all about. And I hope that more people talk about that. I think we need more regulation. I think we need more wealth taxation. We need a much stronger, more robust graduated tax rate, whatever it is. I don't know the exact word. That's going to make a huge difference. And finally, here's the big answer. Why do you deserve $50,000? Why do I deserve $50,000? Why do we all deserve $50,000? And like I said, it's something that is possible. There is more than enough to go around. And I think I gave that answer in general, which is that you're alive. You're a human. You are doing your best. I'm assuming that if you're watching this, you are not a serial killer or rapist or pedophile or something like that. If you are, yikes. But the average person, I'm saying, the vast majority of people in the world are doing their best for themselves and the people around them. And that should be reason enough to have enough to live on. That should be reason enough that you deserve $50,000. It just should. So, featured song. I don't usually do this. I don't do it for every podcast. I didn't do it for the manifesto, but this seemed kind of perfect. There's a song that Rec did on Syzygy for the Weird called Make Me Mic My Mouth. That is on, is it also on the, I think it's also on the greatest, Rec collection. Or is it? Yeah, I think it's also on Rec Collection, the best of Rec 2007 to 2020. But either way, it's called Make Me Mic My Mouth. Mike spelled M-I-C. And it's perfect to share for this episode because it's about two things. Being compelled to express difficult ideas because you can't not express them. You have to. They're burning inside of you. I just have to say it. That's what that is. Make me mic my mouth. This world is making me speak up. And it's also about gun control. There's a whole thing. I didn't know it was going to be that. I let the lyrics go where they meant, but I thought that was one of the perfect examples lyrically that you could put in there for wanting to voice your opinion on something where you're just like, I can't take it anymore. I had no idea how this was going to come together. All I had were a bunch of mouth sounds. And then I put a beat behind it. And then I started riffing on lyrics, and that's where it ended up. And it became kind of one of the more important songs in Rex's catalog because it's one of the few overtly political songs, I guess you could say. It was unexpected and ultimately very welcome. And I hope you enjoy it. You'll get to hear it in less than a minute. And of course, it's streaming everywhere. Questions for you are, what do you think of all this or any single part of it? Do you agree or disagree, or you're somewhere in the middle? Do you agree with certain things, disagree with others? Do you disagree with all of it? Do you think I am crazy? Because come on and have a drink with me. How could I have expressed this better? Was I the person I've been talking about? Am I making the mistakes that I'm saying everyone is making? Probably at some point. Am I not reaching across the divide to people who might not see the world the way I see it, the way that I'm talking about we should do? I want you to tell me that if that's the case. Do you think it's possible in the next 5, 10, 20, or 50 years for us to get to a point where we're taking care of everybody in this society? I'd love to know your answer to that, as I would for every single question, because my objectives here are always your music, conversation, and connection. Thank you for hanging with me for this podfast and gentle podfast. Wonderful. Three, and I'll talk to four. You next week. Love inside your daughters. Love inside your sons. There's nothing left for us here but guns, guns, guns. Fathers hide your daughters, mothers hide your sons, and all we see around us are guns, guns, guns. Yeah, yeah.
Visions are coming real, real, real. Fathers and mothers, does it make you cry? Do you want to shout out to power? Why? Sing it. Makes me mic my mouth.
Does it make you want to mic your mouth?
Makes me mic my mouth. Sing it. Makes me mic my mouth.
Thank you.